exalt thee, we exalt thee, O Lord, we exalt thee, we exalt thee, we exalt thee, O Lord. Would you turn in your Bibles to Psalm 15? Puerto Limon is a remote village, the eastern end of Panama. There's no running water, no electricity, just huts made out of debris from the forest. Take a two-hour boat ride on a dugout canoe, about 2.5 to get there, and that's if you can rent a motor to stick on it. If you do it by pole, it's going to be a lot longer than that. Yet if you go to this remote village, you don't go without invitation. And I remember this past January when some of us went there, someone had to go ahead of time and get permission for us to go. In fact, the day we arrived there, they were having a community council meeting. And at their council meetings, everyone meets at the main hut in the center of the village. And the chieftains will be in the middle of this particular hut, and they'll have these hammocks that they'll all be lying on, and they all have their stick, and they'll use their stick. They'll lift it up when they're voting and so forth. Around the chieftains who are going to be in the middle, lying in their little hammocks, there in the middle of this hut, will be the people in the village, and everyone is required to be there. We came on that day. On that day, they did something unusual. They allowed the children to come to, about 77 anyway, to come to another small hut and have a service with us when we were there visiting. Before they would let the children do that, we had to go to the hut of the chief of the village, talk to him about what we were going to do, thank him for allowing us to come, giving him gifts, and then he said, feel free to do what you wish. The adults have to stay in the council meeting, but you're welcome to teach the children. Now, I want you to think about that. This is a remote village out in the middle of nowhere. They don't get the evening news. They don't get the newspaper. The king doesn't sit on a throne. He lies down in a hammock in a hut with a dirt floor. But we had to have permission to go. And not only did we have to have permission to go, but we had to honor the chief of the village to be there. We had to follow their rules and be there by their guidelines and show respect for them and everyone in the village. Now, if it's that way when I'm going to a remote village in the middle of nowhere, then should I be surprised when it's somewhat that way when I come into the presence of the Creator of the universe? This morning I want us to think, may I please enter? Would you read with me from Psalm 15? O Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend. In whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. He does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken. For a few moments this morning, I want us to focus on what I think is a powerful, powerful passage of worship. And I want us to look at three things that are happening in this passage: the question, the answer, and the promise. And you'll find that in the Psalms and in other literature, like, for example, in the book of Isaiah, you will find similar arrangements where a question is asked either by a person by God or by God, an answer is given, and then there's some resultant commitment or promise that is made by one or both parties. That's what I want us to look at today. Let's start out with the question. Many believe that this particular psalm was a psalm that they used when they worshiped, especially when they came before either the tabernacle or into the temple. It may have been used when pilgrims came from distant places to visit the temple. And as those pilgrims approached the temple, the songs that may have been sung were songs like this song. It's a song that is sung when one comes into the presence of God for worship. There is the reality that we honor God in every part of our lives every day. But there is also a unique time when we directly focus our attention on God and individually or collectively come before Him in worship. If we look at this passage, I am reminded of the questions as he asks, "Who may enter into your tent? Who may be on your holy hill?" I'm reminded of Leviticus chapter 19. The text says that God came down on Mount Sinai. But before God came down on that mountain, God told the people to prepare themselves, to ready themselves, to consecrate themselves, to cleanse and purify themselves, to clear their hearts and their minds of all other preoccupations, and to prepare themselves because God was coming down upon the mountain. Some believe when he talks about the holy hill here that he could be talking about Mount Sinai, where God came and the Ten Commandments were given. Others believe he could here be talking about Mount Zion in Jerusalem, focusing on a time when the temple would be there after David would capture that city from the Jebusites. When he talks about his tent here, or tabernacle, he could either be referring to the tabernacle, that tent which was pitched in the wilderness, or he could be talking about its successor, the temple, because the term was actually used for both. If you look over in Leviticus chapter 16, you have guidelines for the Day of Atonement. And it is after, in the aftermath of the death of two of Aaron's sons, because they did not come before the Lord properly. When they did, they used strange fire and God burned them up. And so God gives very specific regulations to Aaron. He says, you don't basically come into the tabernacle anytime you want to. What he's going to tell him is that you only come once a year. And he says, here's when you do it. Here's how you dress. He says, you dress differently than you do the rest of the year. Instead of wearing the elaborate garb of the high priest, I want you to take that off. You wear that elaborate garb when you're before God's people because you're God's representative. But he says, in essence, when you come before God, you strip all of those elaborate vestments off and you just come in a linen robe. And he says, here's the sacrifices you need to make. And note, it's interesting, if you look at Leviticus 16, before he offered sacrifices for the people, he was to offer sacrifices for himself and his family. He needed to be clean before he could become before God to help the people be clean and pure. I think these passages, whether we're dealing with coming before God on Mount Sinai or coming before the Lord in the tabernacle or later in the temple, we should be reminded of the sacredness of coming before God. And the question is being asked of someone who is approaching the Lord. Maybe they're coming to the tabernacle or they're coming to the temple. And so the song of praise asks, who has the right to be here? Who should be in your presence? And the word for coming in and entering and dwelling, the idea here is not of a visit, though the song may have been sung when someone was coming to visit. The idea is who can live with the Lord? Who can live in His house? Who can dwell on the top of His mountain? The idea is a permanency is being sought by the person who wants to be with God. And as we look at this, really what this is about is it is a safekeeping, a guarding of God's people. In other words, God is not trying to be mean and vindictive and make it hard for people to approach Him. He's giving guidelines to keep people from dying. That's exactly what's going on in Leviticus chapter 16. When you look at what he's saying to Aaron, he says basically to Aaron, I want you to do these things so that you will not enter in before the Lord and die like your sons did. I'm trying to save your life. So here's what you can do so you don't die when you come before me. I had a teacher that illustrated it in relation to something that just happened. I know some of our folks here had fireworks tents, okay, around town. And y'all may remember, you know, during the 4th of July, leading up to it, there was a tent about every 10 or 12 feet, okay, that had fireworks. Now, imagine you're going to start a campfire in the middle of that fireworks tent. Or imagine you're going to put a cook stove in the middle of that fireworks tent. Would you do it haphazardly? Or would you do it carefully? I would hope that a person, first of all, I'd hope a person wouldn't necessarily try to do that. But if they did, I would hope they would do it carefully. Because you don't want the fire and the fireworks to mix improperly. It can become a deadly and explosive combination. Why is that? Because of the nature of fire and because of the nature of the elements that make up fireworks. So why is it that there is such care when a person comes before God in Leviticus 16 or Exodus chapter 19? Because of the nature of God and the nature of human beings. God is residing among you. You have a perfect, holy, immortal God with imperfect, unholy, sinful, mortal people. And if you're not careful about how you bring those two together, it can be explosive and deadly for us. And so what he's doing here is he's trying to protect us. Who can come before God and, as the saying goes, live to tell about it? So you have the question. But then you have the answer. And as you look at the answer to this, you have 10, possibly 11 things listed. Most folks will list them as 10, but it's possible that one of these can be divided into two, and so sometimes you'll see it listed as 11 different things he gives here. I've put 10 for the purposes of this morning's lesson, but you'll notice, especially on one of those, that it could easily have been broken into two parts, talking about who it is that the person who comes before God rejects and who it is that the person who comes before God honors. Let's talk for just a moment about some of the things that he points out. And as you look at this, I naturally jumped to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. You remember in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 28, it talks about when we partake of the Lord's Supper, it says, examine yourselves to make sure you're taking it in a worthy manner. If you ask me, basically that's what Psalm 15 is saying. When I come before the Lord to worship, let me first examine myself. And so what he does is, he says, here are some things you might look at. Now you're going to find other lists and other places. He's not trying to give an exhaustive list. He's not trying to make a list that you check off, did that, did that, did that, did that. He's wanting me to look at just overall, what kind of life am I trying to live? What kind of person should come before God? He starts off with some positive things. And you'll find, basically, there are 5 positive and 5 negative, potentially 6 positive and 5 negative. And he's going to rotate back and forth. Basically, he's going to have 3 positive and then 3 negative and 2 positive and 2 negative. But he starts off with some positive things. And basically, what he's going to say to begin with, he says, he walks with integrity, he works righteousness, and his words are spoken with truth from the heart. And more than likely, those first two things are parallels. And what I mean by that is they're saying the same things in a little different way. When he talks about walking with integrity, your Bible may say blamelessness or in some way blameless. Or when he says that he works righteousness, those are likely just two ways of saying the same thing. In Hebrew poetry, they often like to parallel things, in which the first thing sometimes and the second thing said the same thing in different ways. Or sometimes they contrasted. The first thing said one thing and the second thing said its opposite. But they like to couple things together in pairs. And so I think likely as he begins here, he's coupling a couple of things together that are saying the same thing in a little bit different way. Paul liked to pile up words. He didn't necessarily always parallel things, but often when he was describing our lives, or especially when he was describing God, he rarely just used one word. he usually would pile three or four up together. So kind of view the poet here, the songwriter, as kind of piling on, if you will. And he's taking a couple of different things, and he just begins it by saying, the person who comes before the God should be a person who seeks to live a life of blamelessness and integrity. He should be blameless, in other words. In other words, that means not that he's perfect. We know from Romans chapter 3, verse 10, and Romans chapter 3, verse 23, that none of us are righteous. All of us sin. There's no human being without sin. So if you've got to be perfect to come before God, nobody can. But the idea is that it's a person who seeks to live life to please God and who has no unrepented sin. That when they've had flaws in their life, they've sought to make it right with God. And they seek to live their lives doing what is right. And he also says that this kind of person speaks not just truth, but speaks truth from the heart. I'm reminded of Matthew 5 through 7 in the Sermon on the Mount. And you remember how often in that sermon he's trying to get to the heart of the matter? We've talked about this before, that he doesn't just say, don't kill. He says, I say, don't hate. He says, not only don't commit adultery, he says, I say, don't have anger or lust in your heart. The point is that what I say and do starts with what's going on in my heart. And he says that the person who seeks to live a life of rightness in the face of God is a person who doesn't just speak truth, who doesn't just say what is right, but he thinks it, believes it, and lives it in his or her heart. It's the person we are when no one else is around. In other words, we might technically say the right things with our mouth. But what kind of person are we when nobody else is around? Have you ever thought about how we act and how we think and what we do when there is no one else? You see, if truth is in my heart, I learn whether it's there by how I act, by what I think and do when I'm by myself. Whether it's driving in a car, or late at night looking at a computer, or in a dark theater watching a movie, that's when I find out if I'm a person who really seeks truth. It's a person who lives with the reality that I'm open before God all the time. And He not only knows what I say, He knows what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking. He then is going to contrast that with three negative things. He says he does not slander, does not do evil of the neighbor, and does not join in the reproach of another. It's interesting that as I look at what he focuses on in this passage, a lot of it is about how I treat other people. And he says basically a person who seeks and lives truth in the heart, a person that wants to live a life of righteousness that pleases God, he says this kind of person isn't going to live to hurt other people. They're not going to say slanderous things that destroy somebody else's reputation. They're not going to try to say hurtful things about another person. They're not going to try to do anything evil to their neighbor. And they're not going to this idea of reproach of one's friend. It's difficult to figure out exactly what it's saying, but here's how I see it. What I think he's saying is, it's the idea that when reproach is brought on my friend, I don't pile on. I don't join in when someone else is being attacked. Not only do I not slander someone, but I don't join in when someone else is bringing hurt on my neighbor or my friend. But it's simply put, I won't do things which bring hurt and a lack of respect, a lack of honor, pain in any way on another person, my friend, my neighbor, my fellow human being. He then talks about some more positive things, two positive things he lists. He says, despises reprobates and honors those who fear God. And then he says, they are dependable in what they say. In other words, he's talking about who we keep company with. Am I a person that honors those who do wrong, or am I a person who honors those who do what is right? Now, most of us, when we think about what he's saying here, we're probably thinking in terms of, oh, do you mean we would have followed Hitler? Well, I don't know that that's necessarily what he's talking about. Because while we may not have joined in with Hitler and the Nazis during the Second World War, There may be times in our daily lives when we cohort with, support, befriend, or encourage people who are doing things that hurt the kingdom of God, who hurt people in the world, who are doing things contrary to God's will and God's way, especially those who do not try to believe and honor God with their lives. In other words, he says that the person who comes before the Lord is repulsed by the person who would do evil. So it's not only do I do evil of my neighbor, but who do I hang out with? Who do I encourage? Who do I support? When people look at my life, who are my closest friends and my confidants? Because while we may not be guilty of hurting our neighbor, we may be guilty of having evil companions. As Paul told the Corinthian brethren, evil communications can destroy good morals. With that, he not only talks about who we basically support and associate with, but he talks about the person who keeps his word. Earlier he said he spoke truth from the heart. But what's interesting here is that he says this person gives an oath to his own hurt. It's the idea that if I say I'm going to do something, if I give my word, if I make a pledge or a commitment, I'm going to keep that even if it causes me pain. I don't know if I've told you the story before, but I once read about a story of a slave in Virginia who a few years before the Emancipation Proclamation made an agreement with his master, slave owner, that he could over time purchase his freedom. And his master gave him the freedom to go out and get some outside jobs off the farm or plantation. And as he made money, he could make, so to speak, weekly payments or regular payments, and over time could purchase his own freedom. In time, he found out that there were better jobs up in Ohio. And so his master gave him permission to go up to Ohio to find work, so that he could pay off his debt and be free. While he was there, the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, and technically, in the eyes of the government, he was no longer a slave. His relationship with the master was no longer binding, and therefore he didn't have to purchase his freedom. But this former slave had given his word. And so he kept working, and he kept saving, and he journeyed all the way back to Virginia and handed the master the last payment with interest. Was it because he had to? Should a person have to purchase their freedom to begin with? No. But he didn't have to do it as far as the laws of the land were concerned. But in his mind, he needed to do it because he gave his word. Oh, wouldn't it be a different world if people were like that? If when we said we would do something, even if it was to our hurt and pain to fulfill it, we were a people who said what was right and did what we said. He then talks about in verse 5, those who do not lend with interest and those who do not take bribes for the innocent. I'm reminded of Nehemiah chapter 5, in which you have a problem during the time of captivity, in which the wealthy of the land were taking advantage of the poor among the Jews. The poor people could barely feed themselves, and so they were mortgaging their land. They were selling their kids into slavery. And gradually what was happening is that the wealthy Jews in and around Jerusalem were taking everything the poor had. And Nehemiah was absolutely furious. Because we look in places like Deuteronomy 23:19, Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 6, the Jews were not allowed to charge interest on loans to each other. They were allowed to charge interest on loans to foreigners. He's not saying that you can never charge interest on a loan. In fact, Jesus in the New Testament is going to, in the parable of the talents, going to talk about taking money to the money lenders, okay, and putting it there so you can at least earn some interest. But when we look at the Hebrew culture, primarily among the Jews, loans were not to start a new business. Loans were taken out when a person was in trouble. Loans were taken out when they were about to lose the farm, when they were about to have to sell their children into slavery, when they couldn't afford the wheat they needed to feed their family. And so the laws for interest had to do with, don't charge interest against your brother who only needs the money to survive. Don't take advantage of the poor. That's exactly what they were doing in Nehemiah chapter 5. The rich were taking advantage of the poor, and they were ending up with the poor's property, the poor's children as their servants. And Nehemiah said, this is not right. That a person who would come before the Lord shouldn't be the kind of person who tries to take advantage of people who are hurting. And then he talks about the one who does not take a bribe against the innocent. And I'm reminded of 1 Kings chapter 21 and the story of Naboth's vineyard. You remember Ahab wanted Naboth's vineyard because it was right beside the palace? And he went to Naboth and he said, hey, listen, I'll give you some better land over here if you'll let me have this property because I want a vineyard right here by the palace. And basically Naboth says, this has always been in my family. In fact, one of the criteria that was given to them in Joshua and elsewhere when the land was parceled out among the tribes, one of the things that was emphasized was that they were to keep the family land in the family and in the tribe. And so basically that's what Naboth says to Ahab. This is family land. And what he's not only saying is this is not just that this is family land, but the end result was this is family land given to us by God. I can't just trade it off, you know, one vineyard for another. It's not the issue of the vineyard. It's the issue of who gave us this land, and this is family land. And so what ends up happening is that Jezebel gets people to lie, and she plots together with liars and with the leaders of the village he's from, and they end up accusing him falsely of speaking evil things against God, and they get him stoned so that Ahab can take his land. Bribery would have been at the heart. Bribery and coercion would have been key things in that whole procedure. In other words, it says the person who comes before God is going to do what is just and fair and would never, whether it means getting a job promotion, whether it gets money on the side or something I've always wanted, I will never hurt the innocent because somebody's leaning on me or somebody's offering me something. As I look at these things, they all focus, or most of them focus, on the idea of how I treat other people. And I'm reminded of Matthew chapter 25 when you have this picture of the judgment and the sheep and the goats are being divided. It says that division will focus a great deal on how I treated other people. When someone was hungry, did I feed them? When they were thirsty, did I give them something to drink? When they were naked, did I clothe them? When they were sick and in prison, did I visit them? That's exactly what the psalmist is saying. Before I come before God, I need to think about how I've treated all the people I've walked past in the last week. In 1 John chapter 2, John talks about if we claim to be in the light, but we hate our brother, we're not in the light, we're in darkness. That there's a connection between my relationship with God and my relationship with other people. And out of this, he makes a promise. He who does these things will never be shaken. I'm reminded of 2 Peter chapter 1 where you have that list of 8 virtues and he follows that up by basically saying the one who walks in these things will not stumble. He'll have confidence and assurance in his relationship with God. He'll be making or she'll be making their calling and election sure. God makes a lot of promises to His people. Come unto me, all ye who are weary, heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And Titus chapter 1 verse 2 tells us, God does not lie. As you think through the promises He makes, when God makes a promise, you can count on it happening. And what's significant about this promise is that it ties back to what He said at the beginning. At the beginning, here's what He says. Who can live with God? Who can come into His house? Who can live on His hill? And then it says, basically, the person who tries to do what is right and tries to live life helping others instead of hurting others. And He says, the person who lives that way will not be shaken. Not only will they be able to dwell in the house of the Lord, but they cannot be moved from the house of the Lord. And I think again of Romans chapter 8 and that description at the end of Romans of all the terrible things that might happen to a person. Famine, distress, peril, sword. He says, what can separate us from the love of Christ? Nothing. If my life is lived trying to do what is right before the Lord, and trying to help instead of hurt others. Nothing the world does can shake me or move me from dwelling in the house of the Lord forever, as David said at the end of the 23rd Psalm. Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? The fact is, none of us deserve or have the right to come before God. None of us can. But yet, the Hebrew writer tells us that because Jesus is our great high priest, we can boldly come before the throne of grace. That can only be the case if we are a child of the King. You see, if you're a child of the King, then you can have admittance into the sanctuary, into the palace. I become a child of the King by if I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of the living God and that He died and God raised Him for my sins. Then based on that faith, I confess that faith, I turn away from my sins, and I'm baptized into Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of my sins. If you've not done that, you and I cannot come into the presence of the Lord if we're not in the Lord and if we haven't accepted the Lord. Most of us this morning have done that. The question for us is, what kind of life are we living? I want you to imagine that there were angels at all the entrances, and as you stepped up and prepared to come in for worship, an angel stopped you and said, "Who can come into the house of the Lord?" Have you lived a life before God that would allow you to come into the house of the Lord? Do you have hurt you've done of your neighbor or your friend that you need to make right? Is there someone you lied about this week? Is there some moment when you didn't keep your word or when you let your integrity slide so you could get something that you wanted? Have you got some long-standing feud with somebody that you've never tried to make right? Then I'm reminded of what Jesus said on the Sermon on the Mount. He said, if you're coming to present your gifts at the altar and you remember your brother has something against you, He says, lay it down and go back and fix your problem with your brother. If those angels were at the entrance and they asked those questions, would we need to stop and go fix some things before we came into worship? You see, we need to balance two things in life. Number one, we're never going to be perfect, and none of us ever have the right to come before God and worship, and it's only by His grace that we get the chance to do that. So if we think we've got to be perfect to come before God, then we're mistaken because we can't be. But on the other hand, if because of God's grace we think I can just live and act however I want to and then just walk right up and say, God, I want to praise You now, we are also sadly mistaken. How would we have worshiped today if Jesus were sitting up on that stage? And how would we live during the week if we knew when we gathered for worship each Sunday, Jesus would be sitting on that stage? The fact is, He is here. He is not only here, but He's been with us all week. And He knows what's in our heart and in our lives. Who may come before the Lord? If we can help you in your walk with God, come as we stand and sing.